Good evening, everybody, and welcome to Channeling History. We're the only show where we speak to the souls that made things happen. I'm Barry Strom, your host, and I'll be doing the channeling of the spirits tonight.
And I'm Connie Strom, your co-host, and I would also like to welcome you to our show. Last week, we channeled with three of our past presidents and asked them questions about our current events. We spoke with Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Dwight Eisenhower, and Ronald Reagan. Their spirits are very closely watching what is taking place today, and you will find their comments very much to the point and relevant. It's a very interesting show, and it's available on our YouTube channel. It's in the name of Barry Strom and has over 600 videos. We're currently consolidating all of our audio broadcasts on a new platform where you can download the audios or just listen to the shows. The address for Channeling History is channelinghistory@podbean.com. This week, we're going to channel with three individuals that served our country during World War II and went on to become movie and television stars. They're Charles Bronson, Don Adams, and Lee Marvin. And we're also going to speak with the famous heavyweight boxer, Joe Louis. He did much to serve our country by raising money for the war effort and doing boxing exhibitions in front of over 2 million members of the military. So please feel free to submit any questions you might want down through the chat room.
All right, now we're going to be doing a short disclaimer. So the opinions or statements voiced on our show are the channeled words of the spirits, do not necessarily reflect our opinions, those of the Parax Network, or of our sponsors. And in addition, before we channel, we always say a prayer of protection. So Connie is now going to say the prayer, and then we're going to begin with these wonderful guests tonight.
God, please grant us your wisdom and protection. Grant us the knowledge that we can handle and keep us safe from all things that will harm us. Keep the messages positive and pure love. Keep us safe from our egos. We ask these things in the light of the seen, the unseen, and the honesty of God.
Now we're going to start with Charles Bronson. He was born in Johnstown, Pennsylvania, to a very impoverished family of 15 children. His father passed, and he actually had to start working at a coal mine at the age of 10. And he worked in that mine for 10 years. He enlisted in the Army Air Force in 1943 and was given an assignment as a nose gunner on a B-29 bomber. If you're not familiar with World War history or with our airplanes that we flew during that time, the nose gunner was one of the most dangerous positions. The enemy planes would often come at the front of the plane because they only had one gun in front. And if anything happened on landing and it went in nose first, that gunner was finished. So it had one of the highest casualty rates during the Second World War. He was stationed on Guam, and Charles actually survived 25 missions. He was wounded and was awarded a Purple Heart for one of the missions.
Charles, thank you so much for joining us this evening. Will you tell us about your early childhood life?
There's not a whole lot to tell. We were what was known as dirt poor. We had a very large family, and my father passed when I was 10 years old. So there really wasn't a whole lot of choice. We were in the coal regions of Pennsylvania, and that's just simply where everybody worked. In those days, it was much different. There weren't child labor laws or much mine safety, so the mine owners could pretty much do what they wanted. I didn't go into the mines right away since I was that young, but the time came that I did, and for 10 years, it was a very difficult time for me. In those days, they would pay about a dollar a ton that you would dig out yourself. So if you could make a dollar a day, $1.50, you were doing well. Very difficult time. The Depression, it was just, I can't say that there was much about my early life that was very comfortable.
Obviously. Sorry about that. Could you explain exactly what it was like working in the coal mine? I mean, what did you actually do?
I dug coal. There was no, we would have lights on our helmets. There really wasn't much safety. If you had to know what you were doing to avoid being hit with the rocks when they would come down, they would use dynamite to break it loose, and then you'd go in and dig it into rail cars. And you would fill a rail car, and if you could manage to get a ton, they'd give you $1 a day for it. It was filthy. There was basically no light inside the tunnels. There were very little ventilation in those days. It was just a miserable way of life. It's about the only way I can describe it.
Sounds very unhealthy. What was it like for you after you joined the military?
For me, it was like heaven. I was given 3 meals a day, had a comfortable place to sleep. If you followed the rules, everything went pretty well for you. But it was compared to the difficult life that I was living in the mines, being in the military was wonderful. It was just like a new beginning for me.
Why did you want to become a gunner on a military airplane?
Well, they were looking for volunteers to go to gunnery school. And I'd always hunted, and I thought myself pretty good with arms, but it was a lot different firing those machine guns. Somebody had to do it. They needed somebody to fly in the front of those planes. I was having my environment, I was a pretty tough guy, and I thought that it would work out for me. I didn't realize exactly how difficult it was going to be, but I volunteered, and they sent me to the school, and I got pretty good at it. I actually accounted for a few zeros myself from the front guns, but it's not exactly a place that you truly wanted to be if you were in a B-29.
What was it like flying in a B-29?
It was difficult. The entire plane was not heated. We would wear it, and we were flying at altitudes where it was far below zero in temperatures. We would have heated suits that we would wear. Our gloves would be heated. But if the plane was hit and part of the system was damaged and you lost the power to generate the heat, we had many of our boys get serious frostbite. I had some myself at times. And we actually had some of the crew members that died because they couldn't get warm when their ship was damaged. It was not pleasant. I mean, the ships were the highest technology at the time, and we were as protected as we could be, but it was still very dangerous.
You were stationed in Guam, within striking distance by the bombers in Japan. Please tell what it was like to be on a mission over Japan.
Well, by the time we got to Guam, Japan had been softened up a bit, but they were still fully of the mindset that they were going to fight until the death. They had anti-aircraft fire. They did not have the fighters that they did at the beginning of the war because we had been shooting them down for several years. But they had a lot of ground fire. They did have a few fighters reserved to protect the homeland. We would fly in groups, large groups of bombers, so we could support each other with our ground fire. There were times that we didn't have a lot of fighter protection, but it was very dangerous. Flak was everywhere. We would drop our bombs and try to get out of there as quick as we could.
Would you tell us about being wounded on a mission over Japan?
We had taken some damage. I could not get heat into my suit. I started to get frostbite on my fingers. We had a fighter plane shooting at us, and the shells hit the front canopy in which I was, and I was wounded by them. I stayed where I was, and the guns continued to fire, And I stayed there until the end of the mission, and I received a Purple Heart for it. It really wasn't that much.
How did you come to decide to become an actor? That's a little different from being a pilot.
I knew things had to change for me when I got out of the military. And I used the GI Bill to go to acting school. I thought that it would be something totally different. And I had met some other actors and started to hang out with them and just simply enjoyed what they were doing. I thought it would be an interesting way to try to make a living.
I think you deserved to have that. If our country is attacked, do you think the current younger generation would support the country like your generation?
Keep in mind that before the war, there was a lot of dissension. A lot of people thought we should not get involved in European politics or wars. And a lot of the young people were misguided. There was a huge Nazi party in the country, for instance. But once the country was truly endangered, the young people stepped forward and joined the military in droves. The reality of Pearl Harbor changed an awful lot of people.
You made incredible sacrifices for our country. As you watch what's taking place today, do you think the sacrifices were worth it?
Absolutely. We did what we had to do to save the country. We knew that the odds were pretty good that we might not return home, but we all wanted to assure that there was a home to return to. Until you've lived through situations that we did, you can't really say what's going to take place. Today, we're seeing a lot of dissension. We're seeing a lot of animosity of young men and women. But you are seeing some incredible people still joining the military. We still have incredible youth, and they are stepping forward, maybe not in the numbers we would like to see. But I truly believe that if you reach a real time of war where the country is truly threatened, then the young and even the middle age and all those that can will do what they can to defend the country.
Later in life, you were pronounced dead on an operating table 2 times during a series of operations. Did you ever experience a near-death experience?
No, I can't say that I did. My death experience was wonderful when I ascended into heaven, when I finally got rid of the body that had given up on me. But during those operations, I really can't say that I experienced any near-death experiences.
Charles, I want to thank you for all you did for our country. You were a wonderful person. Do you have a final message for our listeners?
Yes, I do. When the time comes, you have to step forward. The country is a rare example for the world. If the United States steps back and stops defending, then evil will grow to a point that there will no longer be any choices. With this modern weaponry, it is very possible that an unprovoked attack could bring great damage to the United States. Your politicians today, even though they appear worthless, I think would react as one if they had to face the true reality that they had no choice but to protect the country. Our military is the strongest in the world. And in spite of people thinking that we have no business being involved in other countries, we absolutely have to help those countries protect themselves. China, Russia, Iran, they're all very evil countries, and they would love to see the United States destroyed. We have to remain strong. And I do truly believe that in a time of need, the younger generation, the fighting age men and women would step forward. We have a huge military, and it is something that is to be envied. People that look down on the military have got no common sense or understanding of what really could take place. They don't want to be speaking Russian in two generations. So, thank you for allowing me to come through. I truly enjoyed my acting career. I was never a real leading man, but I truly enjoyed what I was doing. God was very good to me, and He is very good to me over here. So, thank you so much. I truly appreciate this opportunity.
You're most welcome. We really appreciate hearing from you.
Okay, next we're going to speak with a boxer, Joe Louis. Joe Louis was an American professional boxer, and he competed from 1934 to 1951. He was an African-American, and he was nicknamed the Brown Bomber. He was heavyweight champion, fought a total of 69 fights as a professional, winning 66 of them, 52 by knockout. He reigned as the heavyweight champion from 1937 until 1949. He enlisted in the Army, was assigned to a special services division rather than into combat. He was very instrumental in raising funds for the war effort. He staged 96 boxing exhibitions in front of more than 2 million soldiers. And just as a little side thing, I didn't get a chance to talk to Joe about it, but my second cousin actually fought him for the championship. His name was Freddie Bayshore, and the Brown Bomber beat him as well. So anyway, Joe, thank you so much for joining us. You were one of my heroes.
Yes, welcome, Joe. You made your boxing debut in 1932 at the tender age of 17. What was it like being an Afro-American boxer during the 1930s?
Well, first of all, thank you for allowing me to speak. And yes, Barry, I do remember your cousin fighting. He was a good man. He was a person that bled, and it was a TKO, but he was a very good person. And I was actually very friendly with him after the fight. In the 1930s, it was very difficult to be an Afro-American boxer. The Ku Klux Klan did not approve of us. They were very strong. And especially during the Depression, many of the white supremacists resented the fact that a black man could be successful and was actually fighting against white people. The promoters did not necessarily want to promote black boxers. It took me quite a few years before I could find a trainer and promoter that would really support my abilities. Being black was very difficult in the 30s. It was very difficult in the 40s as well, even though we were fighting side by side with the white soldiers. The 30s was very difficult. I guess that's the best way I can describe it.
How did the Great Depression affect your particular family?
We moved to the city. My family was very poor. We were just simply trying to find work and trying to exist. My mother was a wonderful woman. She was very religious, and she had a great sense of right and wrong. In those days, the whites would generally get preference on the jobs that were available. There were generally things in the cities you would have a better chance. There was always sharecropping, cotton picking, things that the slaves before us had done. But it had a direct effect on my life. I knew that I did not want to do menial labor. I was uneducated. I could hardly even sign my name. But I could fight. I had to growing up, and I had trainers that taught me well. I realized that if there was ever going to be an opportunity for me in life with my lack of education, it would have to be to match my physical abilities.
Okay, being a mother myself, I would like to ask, what did your mother think about you becoming a boxer?
She hated it, and I tried to hide it from her. She thought I should take violin lessons. Now imagine this big black guy with a violin. I would hide my boxing gloves actually in the violin cases, and she would think I was going to take lessons, but really I was going to the local gym for instruction. It lasted for several of my fights until she finally realized what was taking place. She saw my name in the newspaper, and let's just say she wasn't overjoyed.
Excuse me, I can understand that. So your amateur career was 50-4 with 43 knockouts. Why did you not turn professional earlier in your career? You obviously had gift and talent.
It was difficult to find fights as a black professional. Keep in mind that it was basically a white man's sport at that time. I was actually making more money fighting amateurs, other black boxers. There was a large, in those days, the blacks didn't have a whole lot to cheer about. So going and watching prize fights was something that we would draw very large crowds, even as an amateur. It was a way of making a living. I fought as many fights as I could fight. In the beginning, I lost a few, but as I got better, things got much better for me.
How difficult was it for a black boxer to get a shot at the heavyweight title?
It was almost impossible. The fact that my abilities were so overwhelming was the only thing that really eventually got me to give me a crack at the title. The championship of all the divisions was basically a white man's club. But as I won more and more fights, and as I knocked out more and more of the people that fought me, we really reached a point that the promoters did not have much of a choice. It was a time of the war was coming. There was a Nazi boxer named Spelling. I lost to him the first time I fought, and Hitler used it as a sign of white supremacy. The second time, the fight only lasted less than 3 minutes, and I knocked him out. The publicity that I was gaining was building a great audience for me, both white and black. Boxing was a lot bigger sport in those days than it is now. And I was really, I must admit, quite good at it.
What effect did you winning the heavyweight title have on black Americans?
It gave them incredible pride. The night that I won, they celebrated in the streets all night. I drew great black crowds. It was, keep in mind, there was no television in those days, and they could all listen on the radio to the fights. The fact that a black man could be heavyweight champion was proof that the hatreds of many were lessening. The promoters understood that I had great abilities and the ability to draw big crowds. A lot of our biggest fights were outdoors, Madison Square Garden, places like that. We drew a huge crowd for the Snelling fight. I think there were over 70,000 people attended it. So I did as much as I could to promote black-white relationships.
In 1942, you fought a charity bout against Buddy Baer for the Navy Relief Society and volunteered for the Army the next day. Why did you join the Army?
Pearl Harbor. I wanted to help. I was very patriotic. My country had been good to me. I was now making a decent living fighting, and I wanted to do what I could. I was fully ready to join a combat unit, But they decided that because of my fame, that I would do much more good trying to raise money in war bonds and helping to build up the morale of the troops by doing demonstrations. So I traveled around the country and raised a great deal of money for the government and the war effort. I appeared in demonstrations between probably a couple million soldiers. They loved seeing the demonstrations. It took their minds off the fact that they would soon be going overseas to fight, and many of them would be losing their lives. So I wanted to serve the country. I was very patriotic. I might not have been educated, but I truly loved America.
You were sent to a segregated cavalry unit in Fort Riley, Kansas. How did you support the war effort?
Well, they didn't leave me there for long. Even though I was a well-known boxer, I was still black. And in those days, the units were segregated. Even though the black soldiers would fight alongside the white men and save the lives of white soldiers and do all they could to support the war, we were still looked at because of our skin color. Segregation was real in during the Second World War. And there were many times that, even though I was recognized, I was still told to do things like move to the rear of the bus, give a white person the seat in which I was sitting. It was different times. It was terrible times. But I tried to do what I could to help eliminate hatred.
How did your being in the army affect your boxing career after the war?
After the war, I had lost quite a bit of my abilities. When I was fighting and defending my heavyweight crown, I was very sharp and I was in very good shape from fighting the best in the world. During the war, I truly did lose some of my abilities. But when I got out, I still continued and I still continued to win. But the fights were a lot closer. There were less knockouts. I was taking a bigger beating. And when you take time out for that many years from a professional sport, it's very difficult to get back to your peak.
Okay, as our other guest this evening, you made incredible sacrifices for our country. I thank you for that. As you watch what's taking place today, do you think the sacrifices were worth it?
As it turned out, my sacrifices were not that great because I had a relatively good life. Even though I was serving the country and I was doing all that I could and raising a lot of money for the military effort, I was still leading a good life. I think that the younger generation would indeed step forward if the need was there. We currently have incredible individuals in our volunteer army and navy and air force. We have the young kids in the military academies are spectacular. They have technologies far beyond anything that you can conceive of. They're being taught to use some of the highest tech instrumentation currently known to man. I think the days of the mass military wars are probably over, that they'll be fought more from remote locations. But I do thoroughly believe that if the country was truly endangered, that this generation would step forth.
Do you have a message for our younger generation?
Yes, they need to believe and understand that America is the finest country in the world, and the American military is the finest in the world. That there is nowhere that they can have the freedoms that they have, even though America has faults, even though it has problems, it is still the finest country in the world.
I agree with you on that. Do you have a final message for us?
Yes, I do. I hope that everyone out there understands that there is no difference between white and black skin. I tried to prove that as best I could. I did what I could to bring the races together. I tried to live a good life. I had many problems that I had to overcome. But I was always honest. I was never involved in a crooked fight. I was always doing what I thought God wanted me to do. So I hope that all of you out there listening will do what God wants you to do. So thank you for allowing me to come through. I was a poor black man that did pretty well. And I assure you that any of you out there can accomplish what you want to accomplish.
Thank you for a great message, Joe.
Okay, Don Adams. Now, Don Adams is probably best known as Maxwell Smart or Agent 886 on the TV show Get Smart, where he won 3 Emmy Awards. He joined the Marines at the age of 16 by lying about his age, was wounded during the Battle of Guadalcanal, contracted black water fever, a complication of malaria, which is usually fatal, and spent more than a year in a hospital in New Zealand because of it. After his recovery, he returned to the Marines and actually became a drill instructor. I know the thought that you, when you think of Don Adams, is talking into that shoe radio that he had on the show, but he's actually an incredible individual.
Yes, welcome, Don. You joined the Marines in 1941, before Japan attacked Pearl Harbor. Why did you choose that time to join the Marines?
I knew war was coming, and I wanted to be able to be in a position and to be trained when it came. I knew that the military was not going to be strong enough and that it was going to need everyone that they could find. The Marines, I knew, would be at the tip of the spear and that they would be doing their best to protect our country, and I wanted to be part of it.
So that's why you chose the Marines.
The Marines, I felt, were the toughest fighting corps in the military. They were usually the ones that were training for the amphibious operations. They were trying to use modern equipment. And they were very, very hard-nosed. I knew the reputation of the Marines, and I wanted to be a part of it.
Will you tell us about the Battle of Guadalcanal?
Guadalcanal was at the big, that was in, towards the beginning of the war after Japanese raided Pearl Harbor. The United States Army was learning, and they were learning the hard way. Guadalcanal was in the South Pacific. It was a tropical islands. The Japanese had had years to fortify these positions. They had basically set up in all of the islands in the area. They were dug in. They had airfields where they could get their fighter plane support. And we had to bring everything in by ship. It was a very, very difficult battle, and it was not an easy place to be, to say the least. We learned a lot of things not to do at Guadalcanal, but it did turn out, we did turn out to beat the Japanese there. The Japanese had a different mindset in war. They would fight to the death because they felt that if they surrendered, that it was not in their heritage. They looked down on any forces that did surrender. They treated our boys terribly if they were forced to surrender to the Japanese. And they would do these bonsai charges, which were almost like a suicide charge. I had never seen anything like it before, and I hope I never see anything like it again.
What was your particular role during the battle?
I was a Marine rifleman. I fought with a platoon that was surrounded by the Japanese. We did the best we could, but we had incredibly heavy losses in the platoon. We were saved by other Marine units, but it is something that I would much rather just simply erase from memory. It haunted me for many years, and it was just a terrible experience.
Yes, indeed. Were you the only survivor of your platoon?
There were only a couple of us that made it. It was a terrible thing.
Did you enjoy being a drill instructor?
Actually, I did. After I'd been in the hospital with the malaria, they didn't want to send me back into warfare. I was in New Zealand, and I actually enjoyed being able to train fellow Marines. I had seen the horrors of Guadalcanal. I had the experience that I thought could save lives, and I wanted to do the best I could with what time I had left. Even though I had been was able, let out of the hospital, I did not have a lot of the strength that I had before. So I wanted simply to do what I could, and when I was assigned as a drill instructor, I think that I did succeed in saving many lives.
I'm sure you did. How did your military service affect your acting career?
I had PTSD afterwards. Any time that you spend such time in a hospital, it affects you mentally. You become depressed. You think you're not going to make it. In the beginning, I was so incredibly sick that I was. It actually is a miracle that I made it through it. You are left with your thoughts much of the time. It wears on you, and it makes you almost like you're shell-shocked after a while. That's how PTSD works. During the Second World War, it wasn't recognized as what we recognize it today. They refer to it as being shell shock, but it is a true mental illness, and people that have it need help. Being a drill instructor helped me greatly. It took my mind off the problems that my body was having, and it allowed me to regain some strength.
I think I might know the answer to my next question, but why did you choose comedy as your career?
I was always, well, pretty much of a comedian. I kept people laughing. I enjoyed making people laugh. I could do things that were similar to acting. I had tried being a comedian before we went in for a while. When I came out, I wanted to do something totally different from what I was doing in the military. I did study under the GI Bill. I learned many things. And when I came out, I attended acting school and was very, very lucky in landing some pretty significant work.
Indeed. What are your thoughts on how the military is handling our veterans today?
I think it is totally not up to standard, and I'm being polite. Many of the veterans with mental conditions are being left in the streets homeless. Many are committing suicide with PTSD. It's very hard sometimes to get appointments with the VA. Many times there is a shortage of doctors. I think that the government should dedicate many more funds to taking care of the vets. Many guys are being wounded now with the new medical cares that are available. Many lives are being saved, but because of it, there are many that have serious physical problems for the rest of their lives. There needs to be additional hospital facilities And the VA needs to allow its vets to attend private doctors when VA assistance is not available. And they need to not dicker over paying for the bills.
I'd like to thank you for your incredible sacrifices that you made for our country. And as I ask our other guests, as you watch what's taking place today, do you think the sacrifices were worth it?
Yes, absolutely and unequivocally. Would I do it again? Yes. Would I choose not to have malaria and spend a year in a hospital? Yes. But I would without hesitation, if I lived today and the country was attacked, enlist in the military and do what I could for the country. Today, there are many, many positions in the military. Many different occupations are available to individuals. There's something that everyone can do to work for our country. I think that if a true emergency arose, where the fate of the country was at stake, that the young generation would react no differently than what we did. Keep in mind, during the Second World War, the people were coming off of a Great Depression. So many did actually join the military because they couldn't find work otherwise. Today, there's much work available and relatively low unemployment rates, especially as compared to the Depression. So situations are different. People are trained differently. But I thoroughly believe in our younger generation.
Thank you so much, Don. Do you have a final message for our listeners?
Yes, I would thank you so much for allowing me to speak tonight. We do not get a chance to speak when we're on this side, and sometimes that can be a good thing. And when you get the opportunity, you have to take it. I know my image is not exactly that of a warrior. Get Smart was a wonderful TV show. It actually created a vast audience, and it is the only reason that people remember my name today. Sadly, most of them remember me as a person talking into my shoe. And that's not necessarily a great thing, but you got to take being remembered any way you can get it. Today, people have to be very aware of what's going on around them. It's not a time not to take responsibility seriously for voting for the proper people, for joining the military. Today, the military offers a great opportunity, especially for those in the inner cities that cannot find employment. The military, if you can pass the entrance exams and are clean, provides a great education. It can be used to lay a foundation for the rest of your life. I enjoyed being in the military. I thought it was great, and I would do it again. So if you're in the younger generations and you're having trouble finding employment, think about joining the military. It's a world of opportunity.
Thank you so much, Don. Next up, we've got Lee Marvin. Lee left school to join the U.S. Marines. He served as a scout sniper in the 4th Marine Division in the South Pacific. Marvin participated in 21 amphibious assaults on Japanese-held islands. He was wounded in action during the Battle of Saipan, hit by a machine gun fire that severed his sciatic nerve and also in the foot by a sniper. It took over a year of medical treatment in naval hospitals before he was given a medical discharge. He's currently buried in Arlington, where his headstone reads, "Once a Marine, always a Marine." Marvin won the Academy Award for Best Actor in the Western film Cat Blue in 1965. So, Lee, thank you so much for joining. Why'd you leave school to join the Marine Corps?
Well, I was a pretty rough and tumble kid, and school wasn't really something that I was enjoying. I knew that the military needed everyone that they could find. I was a pretty good shot. I wanted to be in the toughest units, and I wanted to serve to help protect the country. So I was a bit on the young side, so I may have told a little bit of a lie to get in. But I joined the Marine Corps, and I loved being in the Marine Corps. It laid a foundation for my life. It taught me discipline, which I needed to learn, and truly gave me an opportunity to defend the country. I think that perhaps I could have served it with a few less amphibious operations and been just as happy. But I was in the heart of the combat in the Pacific, and I might have gotten it, but I was alive after the war.
What exactly was the role of a scout sniper?
It was one of the most difficult positions. We were all trained snipers, excellent shots with a rifle, and we would actually go in small amphibious rubber boats before the attack. We would try to capture prisoners so that we could get information. We would scout before the amphibious operation took place. We would try to tell them where the shallow waters were, what to avoid. We would try to locate machine gun nests, anticipate where the artillery was so that the ships could attempt to blow them up before we truly came on in force. It was a very, very dangerous occupation. When you go in at night, and we did not have night vision in those days, keep that in mind. We would go in the dark. We would try to establish our positions. We would communicate back to the ships. And we would be observers as the landing crafts came in. Let's just say it was not a position for the faint of heart.
I totally understand that. You participated in 21 amphibious assaults. Tell us what it was like participating in an amphibious assault.
It was 21 trips through the bowels of hell. The enemy was well prepared for us. It had years to get ready. They had their airstrips, so they had no problem having fighters assist. They would attack our ships with the planes. Their fighters were dedicated to fighting to the death. We would very rarely get to take prisoners. They would have these bonsai assaults where they would just have a meat assault where hundreds of Japanese soldiers would charge towards our fortified positions. Sometimes our landing ships would drop the soldiers off in water over their heads, and the guys would drown before they ever got to the beaches. They would attack the landing ships with artillery, with mortar fire. The amphibious assaults were incredibly dangerous. The Marines would do these things on almost a weekly basis. They would take these small islands by assault and move up the island chain and do another amphibious assault. It is actually a miracle that any of the boys that were in these Marine units survived and ever returned to the United States.
Why was your nickname Boom Happy?
I was very good with explosives. Part of what we would do would be to try to blow up some of the installations before the true assault began. And I must admit, I enjoyed using plastic explosives and heavy grenades. It was something that kind of broke the monotony.
If you were wounded during the Battle of Saipan, will you tell us about how you were wounded?
Our platoon was under heavy fire from Japanese machine guns. There were snipers in the trees and they were shooting at us. I found myself pinned down in a position. A sniper hit me in the foot with a round, and I could not tell where he was shooting from. They were firing at us with machine gun fire, and actually a round went through my, shall we say, butt, and missed my spine by about an inch. It did do nerve damage to me. I managed to fight my way out. I decided that if I stayed in that pinned down position, so I ran the best I could and got safely away from the people that were shooting at me at the time, only to find that there would be others shooting at me. The medics did the best they could, and I was extracted and taken to a hospital, and found out this wound was much more serious than what I ever thought it was. And it took multiple surgeries and quite a bit of time. When I finally did heal, the Marines decided that I was not strong enough to return, and they gave me a medical discharge.
I think you earned that. How did these wounds affect your acting career?
It was... an actor has to be pretty mobile and athletic. In the beginning, it was difficult because of the lingering problems from the wounds. But sometimes you just have to do what needs to be done to accomplish your mission. And I remained in very good physical condition. The producers and directors were very kind at times. They understood what had taken place. And I just simply did what I needed to do.
What was it that got you interested in becoming an actor?
I had made friends with certain members of the acting community. I wasn't exactly the most handsome man around, so I knew I wasn't going to be a leading man. But I truly thought that there was a position for me in acting, that there were parts that I could play very effectively. I tried to play, to do different military-type acting. It was something that I had a bit of experience at, and I think that we weren't too bad at some of the movies that we made.
So did you enjoy your acting?
Yes, I enjoyed it. But I also understood that it was simply playing a role. I also tried to do as much as I could for Marine charities and helping soldiers. I always tried to make sure that in the movies we gave parts to other servicemen that had become actors. Ernest Borgnine, for instance, he was very brave during the war. We did parts together. I always tried to bring in as many veterans as I could and give them work and jobs. I was always very proud of being a Marine. I thought it was the greatest fighting force in the world, and I had been very honored to serve in it, and I tried to continue to do the best I could.
Yes, all of you veterans from World War II are absolutely incredibly wonderful people. Thank you for what you did. As you watch what's taking place today, do you think the sacrifices were worth it?
Yes, because if we hadn't done what we did, there would not be a country. You would either be speaking Japanese or Russian, and I don't think you'd be very happy living under those conditions. So I have absolutely no doubt that everything that I did was very much worthwhile.
Yes. You were a member of the Greatest Generation. What's your opinion of the current younger generation?
I would say they're a bit strange in ways, but then so much has changed since I was young. I grew up in a depression. They had basically been around wealth all their lives. Even people living in poverty today have cell phones. It's just a simply different time. And I do firmly believe, as the others did, that they would respond well if the country was endangered.
I think you're right. I remember how things changed when, after 9/11, people were driving around with flags flying from their cars. It was wonderful. So, what do you think it will take to restore patriotism to our country? Is it going to take war, or could something else easier do it?
Sadly, I think it is going to take something major like being involved in a war. The kids have got to be educated and they've got to learn to understand. Just there are times that sacrifices are totally required.
Lee, thank you so much for joining us this evening and sharing your story. Do you have a final message for us?
Yes, I always tried to play a tough man, a soldier. I tried to do what was right with my life, and I tried to set examples for others. I tried to live the true life of a Marine. Today, people look down at members of the armed forces. They have no idea that the only reason that they're living the life they are is because individuals such as myself sacrifice. I think every young person should be forced to go to Arlington and look at all the graves that are there. Each one of those graves represents a sacrifice of a family, a loss, a death. It is very important that the young today understand what our generation did and what the generations did in Vietnam, what they did in Korea, what they did in Iran, and what they're probably going to be doing in the near future. The military is an honorable life, and individuals should look at it as such. I have no time for those that look down on the soldiers or the peacemakers, the police. They need to get a life. They need to learn, and they need to show the respect that the military and peacemakers deserve. So thank you. I appreciate the time.
Thank you all. You're all wonderful souls, so I hope everybody learns about our stories from tonight.
Okay, thanks all of you for appearing on the show. Your sacrifices for our country need to be remembered for by future generations, and that's why we did the show tonight. You'd be amazed at how many people served in the military and then became actors or actresses. We're going to be talking with more of them in the future.
I'd like to thank you all for joining us tonight on Channeling History. This week, we did try to show you the service of some of our most popular television and movie stars. We always try to bring you the truth about history by speaking to the souls that lived the events. It's the only by understanding the events of the past that we can prepare properly for the future.
Okay, all of our past shows are available on our YouTube channel to My Name, Barry Strome. If you want to download them, go to podbeam.com and search Channeling History. We hope you enjoyed the show tonight. We try to bring you interesting subject matter and especially to help you understand history. Thank you for listening. Please join us Sundays at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on the Para X Radio Network.